Most people know that earthworms have both sexes in one individual, but in the marine world, most of them have separate sexes. And so if you're a little male worm or a little female worm, you have to go and find another one to reproduce, which exposes you to predators. It's not that easy to find a mate. So the solution that some worms have come up with is they designate some of the segments on their tail as their representative for reproduction. And so they'll develop a little sex robot. So it's full of their gametes, eggs, or sperm, and it develops the ability to swim.
Today's episode gets a little wiggly in the best possible way. I'm Heidi, and now we are diving into the weird and wonderful world of worms, specifically annelids, or segmented worms, with the curator and head of the Annelida collection at the Museum of Nature Hamburg. It is part of the Leibniz Institute for the Analysis of Biodiversity Change. So this curator, head of Annelida collection and scientist, is Dr. Jenna Moore. She's originally from Canada and currently based in Hamburg. She's especially interested in the evolution, biodiversity, and systematics of marine annelids. Recently, she and her colleagues were awarded almost 1 million euros to conduct groundbreaking research on annelids, or more generally speaking, worms. In this episode, her in-depth knowledge and love for wiggly worms might totally change the way you think about them. It turns out, worms are anything but ordinary. They don't just squiggle through the garden soil. More than half of them are marine worms. They live in the ocean and have developed such bizarre behaviors and bodies that they could belong to a sci-fi romance. Now you will hear, among other things, about glowing worms, worm festivals, and why some worm species act like full moon addicted sex robots. And most important, more than 10,000 annelid species are still out there to be discovered. And just a quick note, when I say rainworms, I mean earthworms, one of those slightly tricky German translations. Or even in German, Regenwürmer. We have only a few hundred annelid specialists in the world, so listen closely. This is a rare encounter with one of them, namely Dr. Jenna Moore. Hi, Jenna.
Hi.
We are here in the Museum der Natur Hamburg, in the backside of the museum, so to say, where there is the Leibniz Institute for the Analysis of Biodiversity Change, ein sehr renommiertes Institut, wenn es darum geht, Biodiversität zu analysieren, also kurz auf Deutsch erklärt für die deutschen Zuhörer. This institute houses what?
Well, the Leibniz Institute is an institute that exists in Hamburg and in Bonn. And there are two research museums. One is the König Museum in Bonn, and the other is the Museum of Nature Hamburg, which has three parts: the Zoology Museum, where we are now, the Geology and Paleontology Museum, and the Mineralogy Museum. And so right now we're sitting in, let's say, the back of the house of the Zoology Museum in Hamburg.
And in front of me, there is a big table with a lot of worms. You are an expert of worms. You're actually the manager, so to say, the director of the Annelida section here.
I'm the head of the section annelids. Annelida are segmented worms, so it's not every kind of worm, but it's the segmented worms, which is earthworms, leeches, and their relatives, marine worms that are also segmented worms. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I'm the head of that section and the curator of the collection. So we have a collection of segmented worms that has around 35,000 specimen lots, which is a jar with one or more specimens inside of it with a number.
So I see a lot of jars in front of me. You have to imagine they are like a small a bottle which contains maybe one glass of wine of liquid and a worm, and it has a very interesting handwritten note on it. Some of them have red tape. Red tape means it's the first discovered and scientifically described worm. Is that right?
They're type specimens. So it's the specimen that an author of a species named used to describe that species. So they're type specimens are the physical anchor of a species name. So, well, in theory, every species name should have a specimen that you can refer back to so that you don't have to rely on the written description of a species, but rather the actual individual specimen itself. So that's what the red tape signifies.
So this is very important because it's actually where science is defined. In the global south, for example, you explained when the people want to find out what kind of species they have, they go back to that kind of description of the first worm. Is that right?
So all type specimens are a reference for biodiversity. So say you go out and you find a worm and you try to identify it, but you're having trouble identifying it. The next step would be to compare it to worms that are related to it, that are already named. So you can go back to these specimens, have a look at those, and those have a name attached to them, and it's fixed because they're the type specimen that definitely this is that worm. And so it's an objective reference for a species. And so you compare your new worm to those type specimens, and if you still decide that it's different, then maybe you have a new species.
So what I found out while we were talking and preparing for this podcast, that there's a lot of work to be done still in the area of worms. We all think there's just a rainworm, but actually there are many, many more. Before we go to that, I want to hear a funny story from you, because you once mentioned you got bitten by a worm.
Yes.
How does that happen? And which type of worm does bite? I have handled a lot of rainworms, but they have never bitten me.
Mm-hmm. So the good news is that earthworms or rainworms are not going to bite you. I was collecting in the seashore in Florida, where I was doing my PhD, and I picked up a worm, and it is part of a group that has jaws or teeth. Often we'll call them jaws, but in this particular group, which are called glycerids or bloodworms, they're actually little teeth. And at the base of each tooth, there's a little sac of venom. So they're not only will they bite you, but they're also venomous. And so these worms have four teeth that are on the end of their pharynx, which is the throat part of the worm, and they can avert this pharynx in order to strike their prey, which is usually other worms or, you know, not graduate students. And so I picked up this worm and I had it in my hand and I was looking around for a jar to put it in because I was collecting, and it struck my hand and it actually penetrated enough that I could feel the venom, which was really interesting. You know, it felt a little bit like a bee sting, but very short. Like I felt it for maybe a few seconds. But I'm the only person I've ever met that's been bitten by a worm like that. So I don't think it's that common because, you know, I know a lot of people who could have been bitten by worms, I guess.
That's very funny. So you're talking here about a species that kind of attacked you. This kind of story came out of a conversation we had about a listener who wants to know why her chickens don't eat compost worms. And so we're talking about predators and what kind of enemies worms have, or to which creatures worms could be an enemy. And then we came towards that story. So could you answer the question from a listener, why do her chickens not eat compost worms?
As far as I know, chickens usually do like to eat earthworms. So I find this question very confusing. Maybe it's her chickens. I don't know. It depends on maybe what the earthworms are eating, but I've never really heard of a chicken
not liking worms,
rejecting a worm.
Okay. Maybe we need to do some food therapy with the chicken. So you're talking about this one worm that kind of attacked you. That kind of shows there are different types of worms. How many worms are there?
For segmented worms, annelids, there's around 22,000 species described. Of those, more than half are in the ocean, are marine worms. And then the rest are earthworms and leeches, which are the ones that people generally know about, but worms are actually, when I say worms, I mean annelid worms. They're much more diverse in the oceans.
And there are so how many do we know about? And what's the estimate of how many are still out there we have never heard about?
So total, of segmented worms, including the marine ones and leeches and earthworms, there's around 22,000. Of those, about 12,000 are marine worms, and the rest are earthworms and leeches. And there's an estimated, we have at least 10,000 species left to describe, but possibly more than that. The problem is it's very difficult to estimate biodiversity, especially in the oceans. Yeah.
This collection here in Hamburg is important because it's one of the biggest collections in the world. The largest, they say, is in the Smithsonian, where you have worked as well. Is that right?
Yes, I visited the Smithsonian twice as a student. Our collection in total numbers of specimens is not the biggest in the world, but it is the second largest type collection of worms. So these type specimens that have the red labels and represent species, we have, as far as I can tell, the second largest type collection in the world. And the reason for this is the very first curator of this collection, which was a guy called Michaelsen, he really liked earthworms. He described more species of earthworms than anyone else in history. And that's why we have such a huge type collection of earthworm species. And then from the 60s until the 90s, we had a lady who was curating the collection called Geisa Hartmann-Schroeder. And she described more polychaete species or marine annelid species.
Marine annelids is the marine worms.
Mm-hmm. Marine worms, yeah. Than anyone else in history, as far as we can tell. So two of the most prolific taxonomists or people who describe species were curators of this collection. So it's a very, very important collection as a scientific reference, let's say, for other taxonomists.
To talk about marine worms briefly, we have a picture in front of us on the wall which shows the marine worms. And to me, they are a mixture of jellyfish, snail, and butterfly that kind of exists underwater. They have a very bizarre optics, doesn't look like a simple worm at all. And this is kind of your field of study. Can you explain this a little bit more?
Yeah, so I'm a specialist on marine worms, and in particular a group called Chaetopterids, which are also called parchment tube worms sometimes. And on iNaturalist, I think they're called fairy tube worms, which I quite like. And these are very interesting because their bodies have their segments grouped into different parts of their body, like a crab or a shrimp or an insect. That's the one that often kids will learn about in school, is that they have the head, thorax, and abdomen. So these worms have the similar separation of their segments into different regions of their body. And so they're very, very strange looking, I think. And what I'm most interested in terms of research, is the evolution of body plans in annelids. So marine worms have a lot of different structures and different, you know, body plans, formats, different kinds of segmentation, and a lot of different functions for these parts of their bodies. And what I find very interesting is, how did they come to look like this? What are they doing with these parts? How did evolution play a role in driving them to look a certain way or another way, and their specialization for different functional roles in the environment, things like that?
And you also mentioned that when you cut them at one part, or when you divide them into three, each part can individually regrow.
So yeah, this particular genus of worms is called Chaetopterus. And they're very good at regenerating. Not all worms can regenerate, though. That's actually a myth. So it's most common to be able to regenerate your tail. It's slightly less, well, I would say much less common to be able to regenerate your head. And these worms are so good at it that you can take a single segment out of the middle of their body. That segment will grow a head and a tail. And then the front part will grow its tail back, and the back part will grow its head back. So you can get three worms from a single segment. Well, from one division and a single segment in this worm.
If we humans were able to do that. you know a lot about worms, and you managed to win a very significant award, the Euro Worm. It's a grant where you got about 1 million euros for your research. Can you just briefly talk about how you got there and what drove your vision? Why did you want to do that?
So the Euroworm project is a collaboration between my institute, several people at my institute, the Senckenberg Museum in Frankfurt, and the University of Göttingen. So it's a very exciting time right now in Germany because there's lots of people who study worms in Germany. And so my colleagues at these different institutes and I came up with this project, and the goal of it is to basically reevaluate the European fauna. Because just for some background, when I was a graduate student, I was in Florida, and it was very difficult when you're thinking about taxonomy and species names to understand what's going on in Europe. And the reason Europe is important in this context is that this is where taxonomy started. It started in Sweden with Linnaeus. And so the first fauna to be described was in Europe, and that includes marine species of Europe. And so the problem when you're not working in Europe is that if you don't know the European fauna and you're not sure about these old names, which maybe have incomplete descriptions or they didn't have drawings and there were certainly not photographs in those days, often the description of the species can be very vague. And it's not always easy to find the type specimens also. And so what you have is a little bit of a bottleneck in taxonomy where you can't describe new species because you're not sure if it's new because you can't access the reference material in Europe. And, you know, so it's a little bit of a problem.
And this is already a problem in Florida, in the United States, where you would assume there is a lot of, collective work going on. What about the Global South? Mm-hmm. It must be even harder to name new species there if you struggle to get hold of
material. It's difficult without a good description of the European species. And it's not that the old taxonomists didn't try, it's just that they lacked the global context. So if something in Europe looks very similar to something in Brazil, then unless you can go back to Europe and look at that original species, you can't necessarily say it's a new species or not. So the goal of this project is to fix that a little bit by kind of opening up the European species information by sequencing. We're going to do genomic sequencing, by recharacterizing the species morphology, and by making those data and those collections available for people to borrow on loan. Because this is another thing that we do in collections, is if somebody has a research question and they want to study some specimens, we can send those specimens away on loan. So the hope is that this kind of removes some of the barriers to taxonomy worldwide. And in the meantime, we'll have a lot of interesting research questions that come out for our own groups and things like that. So
You're saying a lot of people study worms in Germany at the moment. We have to take that word a lot into context.
Relatively.
Because you mentioned that you go to a conference every 3 years and there are about 200 people. So this basically means there are 200 experts on worms globally.
It's hard to say exactly how many there are, but roughly, I would say.
So what I wanted to say is you have roughly 200 or maybe 300 or maybe 400 people who are experts on worms, and then you have thousands and thousands of worms that have not been described yet. So there seems to be a lot of work that needs to be done.
Yeah, just for context, this conference is specifically about marine worms. So if you say that most of that 10,000 plus species to be described are marine worms, those are the people who are going to be doing that. I think 200 is an upper estimate of how many people go to this conference. The next one, by the way, is this summer in Frankfurt. So yeah, the problem is that there are not a lot of people who devote their life to studying worms. It's just how it is. And you know, they're not an animal that you immediately think of as charming or interesting in any way. But in fact, they are very interesting, I think. But again, I'm biased.
We are getting to those stories in a minute. So what could be officially considered as interesting. So worms have what you call toenails. That's what you hear when they scratch over a piece of paper, or you feel it when you gently pat them. They don't have eyes, but they can differentiate between dark and bright, and they don't have ears, but some species might be able to hear in a sense of that they can feel vibration. Can you tell us a little bit more about what's interesting or cute about worms?
So by toenails, it's a little bit of a joke that I have with myself. So marine worms have structures called parapodia, and that just means side feet. That's all it means. And on those feet, they have spines, and those are called keti, which is why we call them polychetes, or historically have called them polychetes, which means many keti, which is many spines. That is in contrast to earthworms, which are oligochetes, which is few spines, because you can't see them. You can feel the spines on an earthworm, but you can see them on the marine worms, which is why they're called polychetes. And those structures are typical, I would say, of annelids. Yeah, so there's a lot of modifications they do to those spines. Some of the marine worms have really interesting elaborations of those spines. Some of them incorporate metals. Some of them are made out of calcium carbonate or silicate material. There's lots of different things they do with just the spines.
These are very specific things, but in more general terms, worms have five hearts. Is that right? Can you say it that way?
To go back to the first question, what's interesting about worms is how many different kinds there are, really. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of diversity in how their bodies work, how their bodies are arranged, things like that. The way we think of a heart is not the same thing that exists in an earthworm. So all segmented worms have a repetition to some degree of their structures along their body axis. So if you say an earthworm has five hearts, it's because in five segments they have highly muscular part of their circulatory system, because that's what a heart is in a worm. Yeah. So it's difficult to talk about worms, I think, because they're so very different from us. Mm-hmm. So we'll apply these words like heart, or we'll apply like toenails, for example, but it's a proxy in a lot of cases. I mean, the heart is doing what a heart does. It's pumping blood through the body. But if you look at how an earthworm moves, you can see a peristaltic wave go through the body. So they're compressing their segments and expanding their segments. This does a lot of the blood pumping through a worm.
I'm just wondering, because maybe the museum will be relocated into a new location. Mm-hmm. And I talked to one of the people in charge of that process, and she said that maybe they're going to put a huge worm in there just for people so they can walk through a worm. Mm-hmm. So such a worm, what would it look like? Would you be seeing six hearts? Or if you walk through a worm, what would you like that worm to look?
Well, if you were to walk through an earthworm, and let's say for argument's sake that it's cut in a section so you can actually see what's around you and you're not just walking through the gut, which would be very boring because it would be a tube from the beginning into the end. You would see different chambers, which are the segments. So you would have, they would be bound by barriers in between them. In each of those segments, you would have those little spines that I talked about. You would have the gut running through the middle. You would have a nerve cord running through the bottom. So on the floor, there would be what is on our back, but it's the nerve cord. And on the top, you would have a circulatory system running over your head. On the sides and each side of the worm, you would have your little groups of spines, and you would have excretory organs, or what you would call a kidney, maybe. They have these interesting little nephridia, is what they call them. And you can
so
actually.
So, does a worm pee, or how does that kidney work?
Yeah. Yeah, they pee, but they pee like all over their body. So
they have a lot of kidneys all over.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, but it's a way of regulating fluid and also getting rid of waste.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. So, and would you see some kind of eyes or ears, or there would be nothing? How does that work?
Ears you would not see. So the sense of hearing is a sense of vibration. So worms don't have ears the way that we have ears.
But they can sense vibration.
They can sense vibration, certainly. But they don't have ears. Like, we have ears, and all they are complicated systems that detect vibration. And if you dig right into your ear and you have a look, there's a little membrane that vibrates when a vibration passes over it. So it's transmitting that vibration as a sound to your ear. In worms, they have a lot of those membranes because they're essentially a bag of fluid. So they can sense vibration almost anywhere on their body because they are mostly that. So
yeah, so the sense of vibration that I have to pick up a funny story you told me earlier about a festival which exists because of that sense of vibration. Tell me more about that festival.
So in Florida, I kind of recommend everyone lives in Florida for a while because all of the stories are true, it turns out. But there's a festival in Florida called the Sop Choppy Worm Grunting Festival.
So Sop Choppy is the name of the town on worm grunting. Grunting means a kind of a noise you make when you scratch a big iron file on a wooden block. So
yeah. And so the reason this festival started was that the people in this town had a business, or still have, collecting worms for fishing, so bait worms, and they're all earthworms. And to do this, they drive a wooden stake into the ground, and they take a piece of flat metal, which is actually the steel spring from a truck. It's these flat springs that they use in trucks. I don't know. But they turn this into a little file, and they grind it over the top of the wooden stake, and it creates vibrations that penetrate into the ground. And the people who are really good at this, it shakes the ground. Like, you can feel it yourself, too. It's not a subtle thing. And the worms there come up out of the ground in response to this vibration. So clearly they can sense this vibration, which is as good as hearing. And so then they just pick up the worms from the surface. They don't have to dig. They just pick them up this way. So now there's a festival every single year in April called the Sop Choppy Worm Grunting Festival. And I went 3 times, I think. It was really fun.
This sounds so cool. It just reminds me of the worm box I had. And one day there came some workers to do some big work on the house, and they used some vibrating machinery. And during the same time, all my worms escaped from the worm box, which really freaked me out back then. But after talking to you, I assume that was the reason. So, yeah, I took the box and I threw it into the garden because I felt sorry for the worms. I knew there was something wrong. They didn't like it anymore. But back then I couldn't figure out what, and now I kind of know.
Mm-hmm. There's a couple of reasons why a worm would escape from a worm bin, and I've not heard of vibration being one of them, but I think that's what happened to you. But the other one is if it gets too wet, then they'll crawl out.
Yeah, no, the other things were just as normal. But yeah, maybe it was something else, you never know. But for me, that was some kind of interesting insight into worm boxing. Worm boxes, can you briefly talk about them? We will put a link into the show notes where listeners can see the details of how to make their own worm composting box. What's the advantage of it? Why should everybody have one? And what's your experience with it?
I think I've had a worm bin since 2011 or so, and different ones in different places that I've lived. They're very convenient because they don't smell. The worms process your vegetable scraps from your cooking and things like that. You can't put everything in there, but you can put most things, I would say. And then you have a box full of worm friends that eat your garbage. So, and then you get really good compost out of it as well. And it is very, very good for your plants. So I've always had a little worm bin. Even when I lived in a tiny one-room apartment as a graduate student, I had one under my kitchen sink. So
everybody can have one. No excuses. And I think the best advantage is really you have perfect compost for your flowers and plants and little vegetables you want to grow wherever. The other thing I found really fascinating is, and you told that story during a public talk at the museum here, which I happened to hear, where I kind of got to know you, this kind of worm love party that happens at a full moon.
Yeah. So again, we're talking about marine worms, which I'm very fond of. So one of the problems that happens when you're a worm that lives on, say, a coral reef, it's quite a big area and a big environment, and you're a tiny little worm.
Big area, you mean the ocean.
The ocean, yeah. So everybody, or most people, know that earthworms tend to be hermaphrodites, which means they have both sexes in one individual. But in the marine world, most of them have separate sexes. So there's male worms and female worms in the oceans. And so if you're a little male worm on the bottom of the ocean floor, or a little female worm, you have to go and find another one in order to reproduce, which is difficult. It exposes you to predators. It's not that easy to do, to find a mate. So the solution that some worms have come up with is they designate some of the segments on their tail as their representative for reproduction. And so they'll develop a little, you can call it a sex robot, maybe. So it's full of their gametes, eggs, or sperm. And it has some eyes. It has light sensing organs, which you could rightfully call eyes. And it develops the ability to swim. And so at a certain time of the moon cycle, worms...
Only at that time of the moon cycle?
Yes, and it's very species specific. So there's not just one species of worms that do this. This is a popular...
And they do it, each species does it during a different cycle of the moon?
There might be overlap, but generally they tend to not do it at the same time or try not to. And so when the light is right that they can sense, this little representative breaks off their tail and swims to the surface of the water.
So it breaks off the tail.
Yeah. And so this is an adult worm that has this little representative that goes off of it, and it's just full of eggs and sperm. It has some muscles for swimming. It has eyes, and that's about it. I mean, these things... They don't think, really. They're very strange little creatures. And so what they do is they go up to the surface of the water and they explode. And the reason for this is that you're taking the volume of whatever depth they came from and you're reducing it to the very surface of the water. So it makes the chances of successfully reproducing much higher because the fertilization happens in the water column. So they have to, their eggs and sperm have to meet in the water. Some species, the whole body turns into this little robot. And so it varies a lot, but this strategy is to basically make the chances of reproduction higher in various ways. So in some worms, and especially actually in Germany, you could see a worm that the whole worm turns into this thing, and they're very large.
And in so, Germany?
Yes.
Where, like in the ocean?
Yeah, in the ocean. Okay. Yeah, in the North Sea, you could see this creature that does this.
And they only do it at night, right?
Mm-hmm. But they are attracted to light. So if you were out on near the ocean, like on a dock or something where you could access deeper water, you could probably shine a light and see some of these strange animals.
Sex robot creatures.
Yep.
So I find that so bizarre.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah. I mean, it's pretty smart if you think about it. It's not that they thought it, they didn't dream this up themselves. Evolution did it for them. But yeah, it's clever. It's a clever solution to a problem.
For a small creature like a worm. And so this is kind of to show how the sense of light kind of guides them.
Mm-hmm.
And not just sense of light. They know what cycle of the moon is right for them. That's a different type of sense, I would say.
Yeah, I mean, they're not really thinking about it. It's more of an instinct.
I mean, most humans don't know what cycle of the moon they're in at the moment. So how does a worm know?
Well, it's the same way you know roughly what time it is.
Mm.
You know, they have a light rhythm. And if the light rhythm changes in a certain way, then they start to think maybe it's time to throw their
robot out. Love party.
Yeah, exactly. So it's not that they're sitting around thinking about it. It's an instinct thing.
Yeah, sure. I guess they don't. Do they have a brain?
Yeah, they have a brain.
How would you describe a brain if you're walking into a worm? What would you see?
You would see a wider part of the nerve cord, basically. I mean, a brain is just a whole bunch of nerves together, right? So it's kind of the same deal in worms. They do have a brain. And it is in their head, conveniently. So
it is.
Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So it's not just the kind of nerve cords you see on the floor.
No, at the front you'll see
a bigger bunch of
proper brain, let's say.
Mm-hmm. Maybe tell us some more about your favorite worm and why it is your favorite worm.
I think my favorite worm is this Chaetopterus, the fairy tube worm. Well, they're very interesting. They have these strange bodies. They're bioluminescent.
All of them?
Not all of them. Some of them. It means they create their own light. Yeah, it's a blue kind of light. And it's not necessarily at night. They'll do it whenever it's dark, or you can see it when it's dark.
Does it shine all the time or only when it gets attacked or when something
happens? It's only when it gets attacked or disturbed somehow. Yep. So that's interesting. But they live in tubes. Well, usually buried in the sediment, sometimes in rocks and holes in rocks. So it's a little weird that they're bioluminescent, because there's one worm in one tube. They glow
in the tube.
Within the tube, yes.
And nobody sees it.
Theoretically not, but the one thing that happens to them with some frequency is a fish will come by and eat their head. Because they'll be sitting in their tube and the ends kind of stick up out of the sediment surface, and a fish comes by and eats their head. And you can find them, when you collect them, sometimes regrowing their head.
Okay, so it doesn't really matter anyway, because they can regrow their head, right?
I mean, it's probably inconvenient for them, but they can, yes, they can regrow their head.
Okay, so, and you think that the kind of light they kind of produce could be to tell fishes not to eat them?
Or surprise fishes. That's usually what bioluminescence is used for in the ocean, is a kind of a warning signal. A lot of deep water or animals are bioluminescent because when a predator attacks them, then they reveal the location of the predator by bioluminescing, right? Or it surprises the predator. So, yeah, I think it's related to that. The other thing is that they have other animals living in their tubes sometimes, like little crabs and other worms and things like that. So it might be when those bother them, they do a little bioluminescence. I don't know. But
yeah. Still a lot of stuff to be discovered. Mm-hmm. In regards to be discovered, if there is a young person, you know, wondering what they should study and they, for some reason, are interested in worms, how do they get to study worms? What's their scientific path?
Yeah, if you wanted to research worms, you would study zoology, first of all. Invertebrate zoology is important. And so my path was, I studied zoology in my bachelor's, and then I was working in a museum for some years, and then I did my PhD directly, which you can do in the US, in zoology also.
And you were focusing on worms already, or you were doing other stuff in your PhD?
I did my PhD on worms, yeah. It was focused on worms, but the reason I got into worms was I did some field work in a little island that's next to Tahiti called Moorea. And this is the tropics, it's very beautiful, it's coral reefs and things like this. And I happened to be in one of the years of what was called the Biocode Project, the Moorea Biocode Project. And the goal of that project was to basically characterize all the species on one island. And it's a small enough island that it seemed not impossible, let's say. It was very ambitious, but yeah. So we did a multiple years of sampling on this island. And I happened to be there one of the times. Well, it was the worm year. It was the year when all the annelid experts were there. And so I thought I knew more or less the diversity of annelid worms before that, but I did not. I mean, I saw really, really cool species because the experts were there collecting them from places you wouldn't think to find a worm, like in between sand grains and on sponges and all sorts of interesting things. So that was the year I got hooked on worms, I would say. And that was just before I started my PhD. So at that time, I was interested in marine invertebrates, but I hadn't picked a group yet. So I've worked on sea stars, I've worked on crabs and various other tenophores, which are comb jellies. But worms were, yeah, the most interesting to me.
And if somebody wants to help you identifying new species of worms, they would have to go into taxonomy. Is that right?
Yeah, or they could, I guess they would have to study taxonomy on some level. Taxonomy is the practice of naming and describing species. So there are a couple different ways you can do taxonomy. One is by studying their morphology, what something looks like, and describing the different structures. This is really important, and it takes a lot of time to develop that skill. The other thing that's important, especially now, is genetic sequencing, because it reduces the time it takes to distinguish species and gives you another line of evidence. So for somebody who's interested in describing worm species, they should learn both. And what takes the most time, I think, is learning how to identify the different parts of a worm and be able to describe that in a way that other specialists will understand, and getting to know the group. That takes the most time of all, I would say. Yeah, just learning the groups is very difficult.
When somebody looks up the Yearworm Project online, there's also the talk about genetic sequencing and how that has changed how we perceive worms over the last 15 years. Mm-hmm. Can you briefly summarize what's so exciting about this change and why it has played such a big role in the project you're doing now?
Yeah, so when people were relying only on what worms looked like to tell species apart, there was a, let's say, a habit over about 100 years where people had all these descriptions of species from Europe, which were not, let's say, complete, because you don't have a lot of reference material. If there's only a handful of species from one genus in Europe, then you're going to compare them to each other, and it doesn't help you necessarily when you go outside of Europe. And so what happened was people started collecting specimens from all over the world and then applying these European names to them because they were all in the ocean. And when you don't know better, you could think that every place in the ocean is connected to every other place in the ocean because these marine worms have larval stages that swim in the water column. So it may well be that they're
all
connected.
That swim in the water column? What do you mean by that?
They're plankton.
The water column means on the water surface.
Not necessarily on the surface, but the whole column of water.
Okay, I see. So it means the entire ocean.
Yeah. You know, if you are not sure, then it makes sense that, say, a species from Spain could be the same as a species in Madagascar. Because if the whole ocean is full of water, eventually they could get around and they could connect to these places. And so this was kind of an assumption for a long time, is that worm larvae lived for a long time as plankton. They were traveling the whole world, and so a lot of species were distributed globally. And so people went with this, and they said, okay, well, this thing in Antarctica is the same as this thing in Europe, and they were applying these names all over the place. And that's, I don't think that's necessarily a bad assumption. It was just the best they could do with the information they had at the time. So then, around 2000, people started sequencing routinely worm species, and they very quickly discovered that there are a lot more species all over the world than was reflected by the number of names that were applied to these species. So in fact, something in Australia is not the same usually as something in Europe unless it was transported there by people. And so there are a handful of actually globally distributed worms, but it's very rare. And part of the issue we have now in worm taxonomy is sorting out what's real and what's not real, and with all of these names that were applied everywhere. So I think actually the estimate of 10,000 species left to be described is quite low. I would guess that it's more. Yeah.
Your path as a worm specialist is very interesting also in regards to the fact that Canada, where you come from, has only two species of worms.
In Ontario.
In Ontario, mm-hmm. which is in the center of Canada. Mm-hmm. And last time you told me it's because of the ice age, it kind of killed all the other species probably. So I'm just, you know, throwing up this comment in regards to maybe young people who are listening. How do I find my studies? It's sometimes, you know, when you come from a place where there are almost no worms, how would you end up as an expert on thousands and thousands of worms? Is there something going back to your childhood that fascinated you about little critters, or is there some link to that, or did it just happen somehow?
I'm from farmland in Ontario, Canada. Ontario is landlocked. It's nowhere near an ocean. In Ontario, there's two native species of earthworms. They're now invasive species also, or introduced species, but natively there's only two species of earthworms, and this is because the glaciers wiped them out, because it's hard to be an earthworm under, you know, a huge block of ice. I definitely did not think I would become a worm curator when I was a child. That is for sure. I wasn't even sure that I would become a worm curator, like, as a bachelor's student. But I think what happened to me, whether you want to do this or you want to avoid it, is that I found something that I'm really interested in and something that I think has its own importance. Whether it has global objective importance is, you know, up to others to decide. But for me, describing biodiversity, understanding how it's evolved, and especially in groups that are neglected by most, let's say, scientists or people in general, that to me is important. I like rooting for the underdog. So it's a little bit of a personality thing, but also, yeah, I like underappreciated animals. And I think I've always been that way, actually, thinking back to when I was a kid. I always liked the weird kitten and, like, you know, like the... yeah, neglected animals.
You say it's for others to decide. Everybody knows that honeybees are crucial for biodiversity, for our survival as humans. Rainworms have also a very central task in how the world works. What makes them so important?
Earthworms in particular are extremely important to agriculture.
I'm sorry, I keep saying rainworms.
No, it's a direct translation, but yeah, rainworms or earthworms. So they aerate the soils. They contribute to loosening them so they don't become compacted, which is a major issue in agriculture. They bring nutrients down from the surface, down deeper in the soils where the plant roots can access them. They do a lot of decomposition of organic material into accessible nutrients for plants. So they're just as important as honeybees to agriculture, I would argue, but honeybees have a better PR team and we see them more often, I think.
I think you are an amazing PR team for earthworms, just to put it out there.
Yeah, they're important animals. And in fact, I have a little bit of hesitation to say that this animal is more important than another animal, because every animal and every plant and every organism has a role. And whether or not they're important to humans directly is not that important to me, let's say. I mean, you know, they may be important to something else that's important to humans. We don't know. And I think putting a judgment on whether an animal is worthy of study, I mean, of course, as a worm scientist, I get a lot of questions like, why would you do this? Why is it important? But this is not something someone would ask someone studying pandas. Mm. So it's a little bit strange to me. And I've thought about this question a lot, because it's like every species has its importance. Whether we know it, whether we know anything about it, whether we recognize it or not, they are all important. So I think it's important not to judge the neglected animals too much.
Well, I think quite a few people agreed with you. I think this mega trend of only looking at charismatic megafauna, which a panda is, this trend is kind of, you know, old now, and people start to realize that we need to look at the little critters, at the, you know, not so obvious ones, because that's kind of what holds the ecosystem together. Mm-hmm. So I think you just answered the question why your field is important. Thank you. Even though you didn't want to do that.
No, I think it is.
Yeah. As a final question, coming back to your award, which, again, congratulations. It's always a great achievement to get something like that. What's your goal for the next? How long does the money last? And what's the goal? For how long are you going to work on that Euroworm project?
The project is 3 years. So that's about the duration of the work on it, although there's always things to do at the end. I'm really excited about it because this is a really amazing group of people, the collaborators on this project. There are worm experts, there are genomics experts, there are bioinformatics experts. Well, there's several goals for the project team. My personal heart goal for the project is to open up biodiversity information so that we can work towards solving this taxonomic problem. Because as you correctly pointed out, if you have let's say, a couple hundred people who are interested in worm taxonomy and tens of thousands of species to describe, at least more than 10,000, that's a lot of work to do. And the easier you can make that and the more accessible you can make biodiversity information, the more you're empowering people who don't live in Europe, who don't have access to European collections necessarily, or don't have the funding to travel here, the more you can give them and empower them to describe their own faunas, the more things move forward. So to me, that's my personal most important goal of the project. We're also planning to study a lot about worm evolution, so we're probably going to make some really interesting discoveries about that. So the whole thing is just a dream, and I'm very excited about it and very grateful for this chance.
I think this is a wonderful last sentence. I wish you good luck with the entire process, and thank you so much.
Thank you.